talk is going to be with Professor Bruno Eckhardt, it's on modeling Daphne and swarming.
Thank you. Being the speaker this late in the meeting has its disadvantages. The phenomena have been described, the models have been described, most of the phenomena and the results that you can get from the models have been described. And I don't sort of want to bore you with another 20-minute introduction as to swarming in nature and in general. We've had this before in very beautiful and great talks. So that's on the downside. And I hope I do have a little bit to tell you, again, on these models for the specific case of Daphnia. And the other thing that happens is that as this meeting goes along, you learn about things that you sort of didn't expect to be fitted for this meeting. And this is this issue of synchronization. And so since Ed and I were fortunate enough to be back-to-back in this two-hour slot, we figured we're going to divide these 2 hours into three talks. The last one is joint work. And we'll do this together. Ed will start out, and then I'll finish it off with a model. And the first two, even though they have both swarms somewhere in there, are totally uncorrelated. I really look forward to Ed's talk. I have no idea what he'll be talking about. So in this case, it's going to be separate. And that's the outline then for the afternoon. I'll be talking about Daphnia, then Ed goes with the swarming, and then we'll tell you a little bit about the crowd synchronization of the Millennium Bridge. And as a general phenomenon of synchronization. Now, if I get this to work, then why doesn't this do this? Okay. So this will be my part, and this is the main actor in this whole event, Daphnia magna. Zooplankton of the size of millimeters, sometimes below, sometimes a little bit larger, swimming in water, and the German name of it is the water flea, and it's used as an indicator of water quality, and they're sort of not that easy to hold actually in an aquarium. If there is any kind of congestion in there, they immediately leave and disappear, and that's the end of it. As Udo Erdmann pointed out, my connection to this is through the work of Frank Moss, who in his lab was studying paddlefish and paddlefish feed on Daphnia, and he sort of saw some interesting behavior in them, which will be the topic then of this talk. So with this, I come to the people involved in this. On the experimental side and on some of the movies that I'll be showing, I'll be drawing heavily on work done by Anke Odermann with Frank in Missouri, and Aini Hongi, who is a graduate student of Rudi Strickler in Milwaukee, and they are analyzing the behavior of these Daphnia in considerable detail. And then the modeling is together with Jürgen Vollmer, Christoph Langer, and Attila Beck. Christoph and Attila are students. He came over for a short visit from Romania. And with Jürgen Bürle, we'll be looking into the hydrodynamics, and that will be sort of one of our main topics in the future, because the hydrodynamics turns out to be less trivial. There is one paper coming up in Physical Review, hopefully soon. The experiment consists of an aquarium filled with Daphnia happily swimming around. And if you leave them alone, then they will be moving up and down, as Daniel Kuhlbaum mentioned. Where is he? Way back there. The typical swimming motion of these creatures is that they sort of hop for short intervals, then rest for a while, sink down because they're a little bit heavier than the surrounding water, and hop again. So there is a predominant vertical element in that motion. However, they can sort of tune their motion, and if they have reached a water level that they like, then they will sort of predominantly go in that plane rather than continuing up down. To visualize their motion, you have the usual recording systems. And if you just leave that with plane illumination, there is a random motion in there. However, soon as you have a light shaft sort of going through, then they are attracted towards the light and they start forming this little vortex. This is a side view of the swan, and I hope this starts now. So this kind of shows this motion in the planes. As long as the light is on, then you turn off the light and they're happy to sink down to the bottom. This is the longest part of the movie, waiting until everybody accumulates down at the bottom. And you can sort of see that their motion is predominantly this hopping type of thing. And then when in a little while the light comes back on, then they're immediately attracted to it, move upwards. But you notice that immediately with that upwards motion, this kind of swirling motion sets in. And so it's the swirling that we were sort of kind of interested in. On the more quantitative side, looking now top down, with this being the light shaft, what you do is you take these discrete trajectories, these hop elements, and you can turn them into something, well, not particularly smooth, but you can connect it to get sort of this kind of trajectory. And then to get a measure of the orientation of this vorticity, you have sort of these two distances, the separate distance to the light shaft, and then you can look at this angle. And then you find that this angle is predominantly located around plus or minus 90 degrees. And that's somehow what you would like to get out of some model that if they sort of move around, they start spinning around in that circle. So the model, as I said, has been introduced before. Udo Erdmann talked about it. The assumption is that you replace this hopping motion by a smooth trajectory, that you start describing the smooth trajectory by something like Newton's law, F equals ma. And then there are a couple of elements that you would like to put in. Self-propulsion is an important one, because they would like to cruise with prescribed velocity. You somehow need to put in this attraction to the light center so that they can know where to go. When they bump into each other, they try to get away one way or another. So you need something that accounts for repulsion between these elements. And then there's the hydrodynamic interaction, and I'll get to that in the second half. And so you write down equations that they change position with the velocity, and then this velocity has this kind of form. So you change velocity, masses and everything is absorbed. This is the self-propelling active kind of part. And if you compare to the previous talks, I'm getting by with only one parameter, because I've dimensioned this such that there is a scale of velocity selected, and that's one. And so there is only one parameter left, which is this gamma, which is kind of this restoring strength. Sort of if you start off with a velocity that is different from this asymptotic velocity one, how quickly do you relax to it? And that's, so there is only one parameter controlling the self-propulsion, because I've set the scales accordingly. And then there is a potential that's supposed to describe the interactions between them and the attraction to the light center. And that's, of course, where sort of the interesting aspects are hidden. If you take an harmonic potential, not surprisingly, things tend to move around in a circle. But the harmonic potential has one disadvantage, namely that there is only one circle. If you start too close to the center, then your speed will spiral, make you spiral outwards until you get to that center. And if you're too far outside, then you will come in also to this one circle. So with an harmonic potential, you only have one stable limit cycle. No matter where you start, this is where you will end up with. This is not really compatible with the motion of the starting guard. They tend to go around in circles of lots of different radii, and you somehow have to allow for that. I should mention that you probably noticed this model does not contain any noise. I do chaos fluctuations in there, but I like things to be deterministic and to not to bring in additional noise. The idea being that if I can understand sort of what happens in the deterministic limit, and if I can understand what kind of fluctuations I get in the deterministic case, then I have a feeling as to what is a large and a small additional noise on top of that, and then we can go from there. So this is in the deterministic case, you really get one limit cycle and not something else. The other possibility is, of course, that you recall the centrifugal force, which goes like velocity squared over r. Therefore, if you know what the prescribed velocity is, which is this asymptotic velocity of 1, the force drops off like 1 over r. And so you only need a 1 over r compensating force to allow for a large variety of circles for these things to move around. The other part is, of course, that if you have a 1 over r type force, then it also gets weaker the further out you go, which would be compatible with the weakening of the influence of something attractive here in the center. So that's why we're a favorite of the logarithmic potential. It's not entirely true, because what I just said applies to a logarithmic potential only of a prescribed strength, namely one that is compatible with this velocity of 1. If you make it a little bit weaker, then the system is open and they will escape spiraling outwards. And if you make it a little bit stronger, then they will sort of start slightly spiraling inwards. But at least you have sort of a larger base in which they can get trapped compatible with this circular kind of motion. Okay. So that's the circular potential then. This is 20 Daphnia. These are the initial conditions, the circles are their positions, and then these little straight lines are their velocities. And the container is included only to prevent them from escaping. A 1 over r force means that the further out you go, the weaker it gets, so they can escape. And in order to keep the numbers preserved, whenever they bounce into the wall, they reflect it backwards. So if this then starts, it's not very different from the things that you've seen before. So this is one that sort of hit into the wall and came back, going barely outside. And so if you get this spinning kind of motion, and it looks sort of like swarming up. These. Okay.
Is that 3D project?
2D.
It's just 2D.
Just 2D.
The pointing vector looks shorter sometimes? Does that indicate something?
Yeah, this is the velocities.
Oh.
And this is the case with fairly small gamma. So this asymptotic speed of 1 is not strongly enforced. They can vary with their speed. So this was then one of the questions we were after. Let me hop on to that one. Namely, this issue of how does all of this depend on this parameter gamma that controls the relaxation to the asymptotic speed. Because if you don't have that, then you're back to a conservative system, and you have your classical mechanics, your classical gas, and that usually does not sort of develop these kind of spirals unless there is sort of an initial angular momentum that can be amplified. So we wanted to understand how that comes about and what the critical parameters are and whether we can come up with some sort of phase diagram. And that's what we got. So this is this parameter gamma controlling the strength. If you're down here, then you're very flexible and you can tolerate lots of variations in the velocity. And if this gamma is 10, then you really insist on the speed being 1. Very little fluctuations on top of that. And then this is for different particle numbers. And this is for different radii of this outer container, showing that they're sort of fairly independent of that. And then what sort of surprised us was not this line down here, because clearly if you're sort of below this critical strength, you should be back to a normal gas. So as this gamma increases, you would expect then to perhaps get the vortex formation. But then if you sort of make this too persistent, too way up, then the vortex disappears again. And we can look at what this then means. So these are will be 3 points where we look at the dynamics. Start with the lower one down here. And then if you let this run for a while, then they don't form a vortex, they're just sort of bouncing around in that container. If I stop this at any point in time, coming back to your question about these lengths, these velocities can be all very different. You have slow ones, you have fast ones, very slow ones, and the system behaves more or less like a normal gas. If we go to this other extreme way up there, then the speed is kept at 1, and they're very reluctant to give up this magnitude, and then their motion is again a very unstable one, bouncing through the center. The interactions are not strong enough to cause any noticeable effect on their motions, on alignments or anything of that sort. And if you now look at these arrows, then they all are pretty much of the same size simply because they're very persistent in their velocity. And it's only in this middle part that you get this vortex happily spiraling around. The other thing that you notice is once you get the vortex, this outer ring is sort of not important. It's the potential that suffices to keep all of them in there. This was for an intermediate strength also. That's the phase diagram that I just had, and that's sort of an expanded version of it, comparing two different external radii, and then particle numbers going up to about 80. There is this band in the middle where you get the vortex. You don't get one if the gamma is too large, and you don't get one if the gamma is too small.
This is with the self-repulsion?
With the self-repulsion.
Repulsion. It's good with repulsion and attraction, is it?
It's a global attraction to the center, mm-hmm. and it's a repulsion between them.
Oh, awesome.
That is included.
What makes the fluctuations in the velocity, absolute values of the particles?
I'll show that in a minute.
And the repulsion is 1/r?
It's steeper. It's 1/r⁶. So it's almost hardcore light. And what we do not have, and this is different, the difference to Maria's simulation and the ones with the most type potential, there is no attractive element in the motion between the particles. Okay. Yeah, now we need to go back. Can't we? We're looking at parameters that characterize this vortex motion. And the primary parameter that we look at is something like an angular velocity, distance time cross product with the velocity. And then we divide by the distance. And if you do that, then the quantity that you get is the absolute velocity, the velocity times the sine of the angle with the distance to the radio to the center. And then that's the quantity that is plotted here from about -2 to 2. And this is as a function of gamma, and this is for different n. And then the color coding is sort of the a color coding of the probabilities and the histograms. And what you see that for a small gamma, this is more or less Gaussian distributed between -2 and 2 with the center at 0, which means they're randomly going one way or the other. Nothing much happens. Then as you get above this critical value of about 0.01, then it starts to focus. And we have reflected all of these histograms so that they focus on +1. Of course, there is a corresponding one at -1, clockwise and anticlockwise type of motion. And what you notice is that there is now a center of mass here. This, the maximum of the PDF is here. And the width gets narrower and narrower, meaning that the particles sort of cluster really in this spiral kind of motion. And then if gamma gets too large, it again sort of opens up. And so the question about the velocity fluctuations is the width of these things which you can extract from that. Which is, by the way, another relevant to the question of noise in the system. if you were to put in noise, anything that would change the velocities by amounts that are smaller than this would be negligible in the internal fluctuations, and it's only if you go above that that you would see then additional influences from the noise. If you play that game with increasing particle numbers, keeping a gamma somewhere around here, then again you have sort of the focus here, and then if the particle numbers get too big, then it again falls apart, and that has something to do with the formation of sort of a very rigid kind of structure in the center, which can no longer be maintained by this kind of potential. Excursions like this one here are also interesting. The way this comes about is that if you're running this simulation at about 50 particles, they will predominantly be spiraling in one way, but for a short period of time, they all reverse and go in the opposite direction. So you can have reversals in this, but they're sort of very rare because you have to step over this potential maximum.
What's the mechanism for reversal? What made the absence of noise?
Spontaneous consensus to turn around.
So
you will always have a few that will sort of be moving in the incorrect in the other direction, and if enough of them collide, and then they can swing the whole thing over. But this is, if you have too many particles in there, this gets very, very unlikely. It's a spontaneous reversal. Can't happen. Okay. Now a little bit on the hydrodynamics. The effect of the hydrodynamics on this motion is something very interesting. The frequently used approximation is that each of these particles drags, behaves like a little sphere moving in the fluid, and therefore attracts a little Stokeslet around it. And this is a visualization of the Stokeslet. So you have a particle that moves, if you sort of take this one square and a parabola like that, and then this is time resolved in sort of different snapshots. And each one of them carries with it then this velocity field, and this is the magnitude of the changes in the velocity that you see in the surrounding fluid, ESO lines of the intensity. And they're not exactly spherical, but they're concentrated around the particles. And they drop off, and that's the property of these Stokes at 1 over r. If you want to become a little more fancy, then you realize that these particles are swimming in the water, that if they are swimming, then they have to be a forced dipole. So you have to couple two Stokeslets to give the motion. This would only be appropriate if they were simply sinking because of the gravity. And then the field falls off a little more quickly than this 1 over r, but it will still be concentrated around the particles. Now, if you do that, and if you look at the time it takes to form this spiral-type motion for different numbers of particles, this goes from 4 to 14, all plotted one on top of the other. And if you compare that to the corresponding behavior without the hydrodynamics, then you realize that this transition is much more quickly, simply because this information that a little more than half is moving one way, gets by this 1 over r transferred to all of them, and then they start moving in the same direction, and therefore set up this spiral-type motion much more quickly. The other thing, which you can read off also from this, is that this angular momentum-type quantity is no longer minus 1, but it moves downwards, and that has to do with the fact that they're now moving relative to the vortex that they're using, and therefore much more quickly. And then, so the rotation is faster, but you also have much stronger fluctuations on top of that. In the previous cases, these distributions were very narrow, around minus 1, but now they're much wider, and we're trying to understand where that comes from. This phenomenon by itself is a little bit reminiscent of what happens in sedimenting particles, where again you have large velocity fluctuations mediated by this hydrodynamic interaction in the system. Now, the hydrodynamics can get a lot more interesting because, first of all, the flow field around these particles is not spherical. And secondly, they can start to follow traces in the fluid. This is a Schlieren photo that, and little movie that Ian Yonggi took. And down here is a Daphnia swimming along. And then you maybe notice this trail coming down from the top. And this was a grain of sand that was stripped in the container. And it was made visible by the Schlieren technique. So this is where this sand fell down. And then as the Daphnia starts its hopping motion, you can also begin to see what its velocity field really looks like. It seems to be able to detect this trace and then follows it upwards, hoping to find a mate up there. So, first of all, the motion and the fields that they're inducing are not really Stokeslets. And secondly, they begin to adjust their motion according to these velocity fields. We've heard a comment about bioconvection. This is one of the phenomena that you can then get because of their higher density. If they sort of swim towards each other, they can increase the average density of the fluid. So it would like to go downwards, and that enhances their motion. So they all swim upwards towards this kind of thing, and then you get a large-scale type of motion from this effort to go together. So some of these things will have to be included if you want to get the hydrodynamics right. And that's something we're working on for the moment. So to sum up this part, a weak self-repulsion will not give a vortex, and neither will a strong one. As the number of agents increases, escape is more likely, and the vortex will dissolve. And then the hydrodynamic interactions increase the vorticity, but Stokeslets or force dipoles may not be enough to really describe what's going on in this kind of environment, because there are traces, the velocity fields are more complicated, and these Daphnia are capable of sort of sensing what's going on in the velocity field and change their behavior accordingly. Okay, that would be the part on the Daphnia. Thank you. That hasn't been done, and it's mainly for a lack of manpower in Daphnia. it was very difficult when Anke Ottermann left St. Louis. They were not able to sort of keep the Daphnia alive, and she has not been able to go back to this, and she has actually sort of left the field now. And so in St. Louis, they're trying to raise enough Daphnia to do it, because you need a large population. Putting tracers in there, I find a little difficult. I mean, it's easy to do, but if you then watch these tracers, what conclusions do you draw? I mean, I have some difficulty interpreting these Schlieren photographs that I just showed you. They're beautiful in showing something, but then you have to relay, this comes from the density stratification of the fluid, so you have to map this density stratification back onto some velocity field. To then conclude, draw conclusions about the hydrodynamics. And it's a bit difficult, especially if you have fluctuating flows or varying flows. In a stationary flow, looking at those particles is fine, but in the more complicated ones, it's difficult.
The biologists that work on this study are
They're interested in everything that makes them move differently from what they expect. And so these hydrodynamic interactions, this question is to what is it that they're sensing, what influences their behavior, will they be, how do they move, will they move in terms of their hops, will they make longer hops or more directed ones, how quickly will they evade something, how do they integrate, how do they find sort of, for instance, this water level in which they're happy. All these kinds of questions are being investigated, but it's sort of not entirely trivial. What I found intriguing is especially this hydrodynamic one. This Daphnia swimming after the hydrodynamic trail of the particle. I mean, if this were pheromones or if another Daphnium had swum there, this would be easy, right? I mean, you would have just imagined there is something in the water which they can smell and therefore they follow it. But with a grain of sand falling down and leaving hydrodynamic trails, I find that fascinating.
Wait, did you say when you were talking about that that they, the hypothesis is that they see that trace and they think that they're looking for...
Well, they see that hydrodynamic trace, and since it's sort of about the scale that one of them would make, maybe they use that as a guidance to follow. It's been seen repeatedly. So if something leaves a trace in the water, and if it's only hydrodynamic, they can follow it, and they will.
This is probably a very, this is a very ignorant question. Do Daphnia have eyes to sense the light?
They do have eyes.
They do have eyes.
Yes.
Okay. They attract the visual light and they might do infrared. So all these flashlight experiments are done in infrared. And as far as you switch on light, they sense it.
I'm curious, the light that you use, is it just a regular directed light? It's not like a laser beam or something like that?
It's not a laser beam.
Well, I wonder, light has the quality of its diffusion itself. You know, it's got a center, and it's got varying light intensity as it moves out from that center. Whereas a laser beam is a coherent light source that's at one location. I wonder if you put a laser beam, whether they would move around or not.
I mean, the question is, would they be able to see it?
There seems to be a need for the thickness of a column of light. Is that right? There's a minimum thickness of the column of light.
Or maybe some particles in the water to scatter it.
Yeah.
You have to, they have to see it. So, I mean, if there are enough of them, and if you send a laser beam in, if you maybe have some particles in there that diffuse the light and scatter it off.
Right, but what I'm saying is maybe they're responding to a gradient of light. And there might not be a gradient of light in a coherent beam.
I see. Yeah, interesting. I tell them. So if once they have enough Daphnia, they will be using a laser beam. Just to see what happens.
This is good. Thanks a lot.